3. The momentous sign of the rise of image-making in its displacement of ideals is, of course, the rise of advertising. Nothing has been more widely misunderstood. Daring not to admit we may be our own deceivers, we anxiously seek someone to accuse of deceiving us. Madison Avenue, public relations, organization men, and similar epithets have given us our whipping boys. We refuse to believe that advertising men are at most our collaborators, helping us make illusions for ourselves. In our moral indignation, our eagerness to find the villains who have created and frustrated our exaggerated expectations, we have underestimated the effect of the rise of advertising. We think it has meant an increase in untruthfulness. In fact, it has meant a reshaping of our very concept of truth. Advertising, from its modern American beginnings, was a classic example of the pseudo-event. It was a prototype of made news. The modern era in American advertising dates from the epoch when advertisements ceased to be repetitive announcements naively describing services or products for sale, and by being contrived and being given the artificial aroma of news, took on the aspect of other pseudo-events. Modern advertising began when the advertisement was no longer a spontaneous announcement and had become made news. James Gordon Bennett, 1795 to 1872, who founded the New York Herald on May 7, 1835 as a one-cent daily paper, and who was one of the pioneers of modern American journalism, inaugurated the new era when he abolished the old standing ad. Formerly, a commercial announcement would be left standing in type. Sometimes it ran unaltered for as long as a year at a time. Such standing ads were, in fact, the rule in the advertising columns of newspapers. Advertising matter of this kind obviously could offer readers little or nothing of newsworthy interest. Wishing to make the advertisements as newsworthy as everything else in his Herald, Bennett announced in 1847 that he would take no advertisements for more than 2 weeks' insertion. Then, in 1848, he began the policy of accepting no advertisement for more than 1 day's insertion. This required advertisers to change their notices daily. Bennett's son, who succeeded him as editor of the Herald, showed a similar vigor and ingenuity in devising stunts to advertise the newspaper itself. For example, he sent Stanley to Africa to look for Livingstone. 1871. The news interest in advertisements has increased with the rising American standard of living, the rising level of expectations, and the growing ingenuity of copywriters. Readers enjoy the sense of being courted. They luxuriate in the knowledge that so much money, time, effort, and art have gone into making all these pseudo-events especially for them. The newspaper PM, launched on its brief life as a self-righteous adless daily in 1940, failed in part because readers missed the advertising news to which they had become accustomed. Statistical studies of reader interest made by the Market Research Foundation, 1940 to 1950, indicated an increased interest in advertising. Readers seemed to find about as much interest in advertising as in regular news and editorial features. It has become a commonplace of American journalism that the most successful, that is, the most appealing, newspapers and magazines are those with the most advertising. The Reader's Digest had long been an exception, but when, in November 1954, inflation and mounting costs made Wallace decide to include advertising in order to avoid raising the price of the magazine, the Digest promised to print only advertising of unusually high reader interest. 3 years' experience justified the Digest's official historian in concluding that most Americans like advertising. They expect to find it in their magazines. They read it as news. They are conscious of advertising and look to it for excitement and novelty. When the Reader's Digest began to take advertising in 1955, it added to its value as a complete magazine. This is not merely a way of saying that nothing succeeds like success. It is also a way of saying what has not always and everywhere been true. that the public enjoys an even greater abundance of advertising news. The successful American advertiser knows how to make news. A notorious pioneer was P.T. Barnum, 1810 to 1891, whom advertising textbooks still treat as the first large-scale practitioner of many modern publicity techniques. He was a genius at making pseudo-events, although they were often so crude that they could not titillate us today. He made news even by his attitude toward advertising. "I thoroughly understood the art of advertising," boasted Barnum in his autobiography. "Not merely by means of printer's ink, which I have always used freely, and to which I confess myself much indebted for my success, but by turning every possible circumstance to my account." In 1835, he exhibited Joyce Heth, an aged negress whom he advertised as the 161-year-old former nurse of George Washington. For a while, he made $1,500 a week from her. Showing his mastery of the art of compounding pseudo-events, he then increased his publicity by attacking the whole exhibition as a hoax. "The fact is, Joyce Heth is not a human being," he wrote in newspapers. "Simply a curiously constructed automaton made up of whalebone, india rubber, and numerous springs ingeniously put together and made to move at the slightest touch, according to the will of the operator. The operator is a ventriloquist." An autopsy done at the time of her death indicated that Joyce Heth was about 80 years old. Barnum then multiplied publicity by having her buried in his family plot. He wrote a series of articles exposing the fraud and reasserting his own good faith. In 1841, Barnum managed to buy Scudder's American Museum, a private collection of curiosities exhibited for profit. The museum, once well-known and profitable, was then losing money. When Barnum told a friend that he intended to buy the museum, the asking price was $15,000, the friend replied in astonishment, "What do you intend buying it with?" "Brass," retorted Barnum, "for silver and gold have I none." He increased and diversified the transient attractions, exhibiting, according to his own list, educated dogs, industrious fleas, automatons, jugglers, ventriloquists, living statuary, tableau, gypsies, albinos, fat boys, giants, dwarfs, rope dancers, live Yankees, pantomime, instrumental music, singing and dancing in great variety, dioramas, panoramas, models of Niagara, Dublin, Paris, and Jerusalem, Hannington's dioramas of the creation, the deluge, fairy grotto, storm at sea, the first English Punch and Judy in this country, Italian Fantoccini mechanical figures, fancy glass blowing, knitting machines, and other triumphs in the mechanical arts, dissolving views, American Indians who enacted their warlike and religious ceremonies on the stage. These, among others, were all exceedingly successful. Barnum's American Museum soon became one of New York's major tourist attractions. It was to advertise this museum that he invented his famous Brick Man, a perfect, if somewhat primitive, example of the connection between pseudo-events and advertising. Barnum hired a stout, hearty-looking man for $1.50 a day and handed him 5 bricks. He instructed the man to lay 1 brick at each of the 4 points which Barnum indicated near the American Museum. The man kept the 5th brick in his hand and marched rapidly from 1 brick to another, at each point exchanging the one in his hand for the one on the street. He kept this up in a constant circuit. At the end of every hour, however, the brick man entered the American Museum, spent 15 minutes solemnly surveying all the halls, then left and resumed his work. Each time, a dozen or more persons would buy tickets and follow him into the museum, hoping to learn the purpose of his movements. Their entrance fees more than paid the brick man's wages. Additional interest was created when a policeman, who had been let in on the trick, objected that the crowds were obstructing traffic and ordered Barnum to call in his brickman. This trivial incident, Barnum recounted, excited considerable talk and amusement. It advertised me, and it materially advanced my purpose of making a lively corner near the museum. One of Barnum's great successes was his mermaid. A painting outside the museum depicted an attractive half-woman, half-fish about 8 feet long. Illustrated handbills portrayed her capture on a Pacific island. The specimen was said to have been purchased by a Dr. Griffith as agent for the Lyceum of Natural History in London. Barnum had this Dr. Griffith, who was in fact a Barnum assistant named Lyman, exhibit it before a large meeting of New York scientists in the concert hall. Actually, what was being exhibited was only the preserved head of a monkey attached to the dried body of a fish. The public appeared to be satisfied, Barnum recalled. But as some persons always will take things literally and make no allowance for poetic license, even in mermaids, an occasional visitor, after having seen the large transparency in front of the hall, representing a beautiful creature, half woman and half fish, would be slightly surprised to find that the reality was a black-looking specimen of dried monkey and fish that a boy a few years old could easily run away with under his arm. Other Barnum triumphs were General Tom Thumb, a 5-year-old dwarf who was less than 2 feet high and weighed 16 pounds when he was first displayed on Thanksgiving Day 1842, and who attracted over 100,000 people in the first year. And Jenny Lind, the Swedish nightingale, whose real name was Madame Otto Goldschmidt. She was advertised as being paid $1,000 a concert, all of which she supposedly gave to charity. Barnum first opened the greatest show on earth in Brooklyn in 1871. There, and on tour, he displayed countless freaks and monstrosities, among them Jumbo, a large, gentle African elephant advertised as the only mastodon on earth. Contrary to popular belief, Barnum's great discovery was not how easy it was to deceive the public, but rather how much the public enjoyed being deceived, especially if they could see how it was being done. They were flattered that anyone would use such ingenuity to entertain them. Barnum argued that his claptrap was perfectly justifiable so long as it was occasionally mixed up with the great realities which I provide. The titles of humbug and prince of humbugs were first applied to me by myself. I made these titles a part of my stock in trade. Barnum's autobiography, Struggles and Triumphs, published in 1854, the year of Thoreau's Walden, recounted his exploits with disarming candor and precise detail. It soon became a bestseller. Barnum was perhaps the first modern master of pseudo-events, of contrived occurrences which led themselves to being widely and vividly reported. When his winter circus quarters burned, he managed to pyramid the news by announcing that insurance had covered only a fraction of the losses. When newspapers disputed him, he remained unconcerned, finding that the insurance controversy itself was a fruitful source of additional publicity. When Jumbo, the African elephant, was killed in a railroad accident, Barnum put out the story that Jumbo died sacrificing himself to save a baby elephant. He then imported Alice, whom he billed as Jumbo's widow, posing her next to the stuffed body of her deceased husband. Barnum was a doubly appropriate symbol of the opening of the era of the graphic revolution. By making colossal pseudo-events, he himself became a celebrity. A talent for advertising and a talent for making news have ever since been connected. Albert D. Lasker, an advertising master of the 20th century, once characterized all good advertising as news. Advertising, however, contained an ingredient not generally found in other pseudo-events which were mere made news. For while any pseudo-event, an interview for example, was a happening incited into existence for the purpose of being reported, an advertisement was designed to suggest not merely that something had happened, but also that something was good. An advertisement usually conjured up an image in order to persuade people that something was worth buying. It combined a pseudo-event with a pseudo-ideal. The pseudo-event must be vividly newsworthy. The pseudo-ideal must be vividly desirable. Much of the appeal of advertising has actually consisted in its effort, which we all appreciate, to satisfy our extravagant expectations. The deeper problems connected with advertising come less from the unscrupulousness of our deceivers than from our pleasure in being deceived. Less from the desire to seduce than from the desire to be seduced. The graphic revolution has produced new categories of experience. They are no longer simply classifiable by the old common sense tests of true or false. 4. Our frenetic earnestness to attack advertising, our fear of advertising, and our inability to fit advertising into old-time familiar cubbyholes of our experience, all these prevent us from seeing its all-encompassing significance as a touchstone of our changing concept of knowledge and of reality. Our attitude toward advertising is comparable to the 18th-century English and American attitude toward insanity and mental disorders. Unable to understand the insane, the sane, respectable people of London saw in them something wicked and diabolical. Put them in chains, confine them in bedlam, punish them with whips. Madmen ceased to be treated as half-witch, half-criminal only in the later 19th and early 20th century, when physicians, psychiatrists, and psychoanalysts helped us see that madmen suffered from mental diseases. The great forward steps in public understanding came only when people began to realize that the disorders of the insane and the perverted, hysteria, paranoia, schizophrenia, homosexuality, etc., were only extreme examples of tendencies in each of us normal people. The understanding of insanity in this way has gradually led each of us to a better understanding of himself. Similarly with advertising. Baffled and suspicious, we deride the witch doctors of Madison Avenue. It is they, we say, who want to involve us in the figments of their disordered imaginations. They lie to us. They persuade us against our will. Accusing them, we fail to see what their activities can teach us about ourselves. Since the graphic revolution, the multiplication of images has had a revolutionary effect on all our imaginations, on our concept of verisimilitude, on what passes for truth in common experience. This can be summed up as the shift in common experience from an emphasis on truth to an emphasis on credibility. All of us, not merely the supposed witch doctors of Madison Avenue, but all American citizen consumers, are daily less interested in whether something is a fact than in whether it is convenient that it should be believed. Today, the master of truth is not the master of facts, but the practitioner of the arts of the self-fulfilling prophecy. What seems important is not truth, but verisimilitude. In this new world, where almost anything can be true, the socially rewarded art is that of making things seem true. It is the art not of discovery, but of invention. Finding a fact is easy. Making a fact believed is slightly more difficult. The greatest effort goes into the realization not of dreams, but of illusions. God makes our dreams come true. Skillful advertising men bring us our illusions, then make them seem true. The whole American tradition of pragmatism, from Benjamin Franklin, who insisted that it was less important whether any religious belief was true than whether the consequences of the belief were wholesome, down to William James, who explored the consequences of the will to believe and focused interest on how whatever people believed or wanted to believe overshadowed whatever might be out there in the real world, this tradition has expressed a consuming interest in the appearances of things. One explanation of increasing American interest in credibility is a simple paradox of the graphic revolution. While that revolution has multiplied and vivified our images of the world, it has by no means generally sharpened or clarified the visible outlines of the world which fill our experience. Quite the contrary. By a diabolical irony, the very facsimiles of the world which we make on purpose to bring it within our grasp, to make it less elusive, have transported us into a new world of blurs. By sharpening our images, we have blurred all our experience. The new images have blurred traditional distinctions. The broadest of the old distinctions, which no longer service as they did, is the distinction between true and false. Well-meaning critics, including many in the advertising profession, who say the essential problem is false advertising, are firing volleys at an obsolete target. Few advertisers are liars. A strong advertising profession has its own earnest ethic. Lies are not so readily diffused through newspapers and magazines, over radio and television. They are not so eagerly believed. The evils of advertising could be easily enough reduced if they came only from lies. The deeper problem is quite different. In some ways, it is quite opposite. Advertising befuddles our experience, not because advertisers are liars, but precisely because they are not. Advertising fogs our daily lives less from its peculiar lies than from its peculiar truths. The whole apparatus of the graphic revolution has put a new elusiveness, iridescence, and ambiguity into everyday truth in 20th century America. The so-called Baltimore Truth Declaration, which was adopted at an early convention of advertising men in 1913, committed them to truth in advertising. This later became the slogan of the Advertising Federation of America and its local affiliates. Advertisers were welcomed to that historic convention by the word truth displayed in the largest electric sign yet erected in Baltimore. On the whole, the advertising profession has since then followed its credo with a dangerously literal persistence. The advertising profession was founded on truth, but it has survived by its power to give truth a new meaning. Several novel appeals have come to characterize the most successful advertising statements. All are both effects and causes of our exaggerated expectations, products and byproducts of image thinking. These first developed in advertising, but have spread out to all our experience. As nature now imitates art, as the geysers in Yellowstone now provide us tourist attractions, more and more of our experience nowadays imitates advertising. The pseudo-event, or that which looks like a pseudo-event, seldom fails to dominate. 1. The appeal of the neither true nor false. The larger proportion of advertising statements subsist in this new limbo. They cannot be parsed in the old grammar of epistemology because modern experience is newly ambiguous. The complexity of new manufacturing processes, the new vagueness that can be designed into vivid images, the new uncertainty of relation between the image and the thing imaged, is it an actual photograph? All of these make the simple question, is it true, as obsolete as the horse and buggy. Here, too, the once simple notion of an original has acquired a tantalizing ambiguity bordering on meaninglessness. The advertiser's art, then, consists largely of the art of making persuasive statements which are neither true nor false. He does not violate the old truth morality. Rather, like the newsmaker, he evades it. It is not only advertising which has become a tissue of contrivance and illusion. Rather, it is the whole world. The ambiguities and delusions of advertising are only symptoms. Advertising events are no less or more unreal than all other pseudo-events. A few commonplace examples will suffice. One of the most familiar is the use of the open comparative adjective, the better beer, without specifying that with which it is being compared. This can hardly fail to be true of every beer which is not the worst in the world. When Claude C. Hopkins, One of the pioneers of American advertising took on the Schlitz beer account some years ago. He prepared himself by learning all he could about brewing. On his tour through the Schlitz brewery, Hopkins noticed that the bottles were purified by live steam before being filled. This caught his fancy. He developed an advertising program around the notion that Schlitz beer was pure because the bottles were steam sterilized. Schlitz quickly rose from fifth place in national sales to near first place. What he said was, of course, gospel truth. Consumers simply did not know enough about beer making to realize that the beer of every respectable brand was bottled in this way. The use of live steam by Schlitz became a more vivid fact than its use by any of the competitors. Hopkins had concocted the pseudo-event he was looking for. He had made news. This pseudo-event was then given a nationally advertised dignity, making it predominate over the same prosaic fact which was equally true about all reputable beers. Competitors dared not match the boast for fear they might seem to be imitating Schlitz. Schlitz continued to sell as the beer in sterilized bottles. This was a fact if there ever was one. Yet, by being touted as a pseudo-event, it became only a quasi-truth. This itself made it overshadow the simple facts. Lucky Strike cigarettes sold well by preempting the slogan, "It's toasted." They were toasted. So was every other American cigarette. Soon, the sales of Lucky Strike reached nearly 6 billion cigarettes a year. The growing field of packaged foods, drugs, and cosmetics is a world of just such quasi-information. Toothpastes are ammoniated. Hair tonics contain lanolin. One even contains cholesterol, the heart of lanolin. Of course they really do contain what they say. Advertisers are so honest, they will even concoct a chemical in order to be able truthfully to advertise it. Statements are given a peculiar, specious kind of truth, and an overshadowing vividness in the process of being made into pseudo-events. What is called for in these advertising situations is less a verifiable fact than a credible statement. The credibility cannot exist without the truth. The seduction cannot exist without the falsehood. As pseudo-events, of course, they are all quite reputable. 2. The appeal of the self-fulfilling prophecy. The graphic revolution has given advertisers, like newsmakers, celebrity makers, tour agents, movie directors, do-it-yourself photographers, and each of us in a thousand new ways, an unprecedented power to make things true. Much of our befuddlement, I have suggested, comes from the fact that advertisers insist on offering only statements that are true. They go to the most devious lengths, employing the most ingenious devices, to procure a persuasive credibility which passes for truth in our everyday life. The successful advertiser is the master of a new art, the art of making things true by saying they are so. He is a devotee of the technique of the self-fulfilling prophecy. An elementary example is testimonial endorsement advertising, which has been elaborated in this century. Even at common law, statements employed to promote sale were called puffs and were allowed wide latitude. A puff, even if not literally true, was not necessarily legally actionable. Much of the ingenuity of modern advertising derives from the refusal to accept this traditional latitude, and the effort instead to force other facts into being in order to make an improbable fact seem true. So straightforward a statement as one that someone approves or uses a product has become one of the most interesting of pseudo-events. From a most simple declaration of fact, it has become a formula of compounding ambiguity. What could have been a more unambiguous statement once upon a time than to say about any product that a particular person, say Mr. J. Edgar Hoover, director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, used it? Nowadays, the commercial value of such statements, plus the insistence of reputable advertising agencies on being truthful, has loaded just such simple declaratory sentences with all kinds of innuendo. We can read about this in William M. Freeman's Big Name, 1957, a practical handbook on how to secure credible testimonials and how to use them in advertising. Endorsements have become a specialized and profitable enterprise. Dealers in big names have made them big business. According to Jules Alberti, president of Endorsements Incorporated, a firm specializing in bringing together advertiser and endorser, the endorsement business has prospered. Between 1945 and 1957, he observed, approximately 8,000 celebrities have been used in all combined media, including television, for approximately 4,500 separate products. They have covered apparel, household appliances, cosmetics, beverages, food, tobacco, jewelry, autos, etc. This was through approximately 1,400 agencies. The combined cost of media space and time in 12 years runs well over $700 million. The combined fees paid to celebrities were probably about 1% of this amount. Rarely does anyone become a celebrity solely by selling his name or his picture for endorsements, but even this phenomenon, no paradox in the world of celebrities, where a celebrity is a person known for his well-knownness, occasionally does occur. For example, the Hathaway shirt man with the patch on his eye, the bearded Commander Whitehead, Schweppes tonic endorser, the attractive fire and ice model for Revlon nail polish and lipstick, and Miss Rheingold. The endorsement business usually deals in personalities who have already become celebrities in some way, namely movie stars, sports figures, and beauty queens. Planning an endorsement requires as much finesse as planning a newsworthy interview or any other successful pseudo-event. It is partly, as Freeman says, a matter of good casting, of matching the right product to the right name. The celebrity, of course, need not be always the actual user of a product, Freeman explains. On a household item such as an air refresher, the testimonials are wanted from the domestic staffs of well-known persons. The resulting advertising would then say, "This is the product used in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Hollywood Star." Presumably, the celebrities would not know what products are used in their establishments, and the endorsement is all the more believable when it comes from an employee. The dangers of miscasting are considerable, observed Edward Carroll, sales promotion manager of Hess Brothers Department Store in Allentown, Pennsylvania, a store noted for its progressive merchandising methods. He notes the mistake of using pretty girls indiscriminately to sell all kinds of products. Sleepy, seductive models shouldn't be shown in advertising holding pots and pans. The Marjorie Main photo type of model belongs with the pot and pan ads, while the mannequin who looks like Marilyn Monroe is just fine in bathing suits. No sincere advertiser would think of advertising a roasting pan for $1.95 and then marking it up to $2.95 when the customer came into the store. That would be outright misrepresentation. And so is a beautiful, enticing Marilyn Monroe type pictured in an ad holding a mop in a typical family kitchen scene. The same goes for a Marlene Dietrich shown struggling over the kitchen range, or the Ava Gardner counterpart wielding a vacuum cleaner. The latter role should be cast the Spring Byington type. The sense of appropriateness must often be delicate. Mr. Carroll advised that Marilyn Monroe herself, although an eminently appropriate endorser for bathing suits, strapless and backless evening gowns, negligees, diamonds, and furs, should not be cast in underwear advertising. Here, credibility would be sacrificed, since, as he says, Miss Monroe has actually stated publicly that she does not wear such garments. Experience and know-how are useful in securing endorsements. Certain celebrities are unobtainable or will endorse only certain kinds of products. For example, Clyde Beatty, the lion trainer, will not endorse anything linked to alcohol. Buster Crabbe, starred on television as Captain Gallant of the Foreign Legion, will not endorse any product he does not think good and healthy. Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, and some other celebrities who appeal primarily to a juvenile audience are reluctant to endorse a cigarette or any other product not for young people. Endorsement agencies maintain lists of the most wanted names, arranged both by the fields in which each name is a celebrity and by the kind of product for which each would be appropriate. Almost any celebrity has a well-knownness which can be attached to some product, service, or institution. In the decline of American society, as Cleveland Amory notes, an epoch was marked when the first member of Authentic Society signed her first commercial testimonial. Mrs. James Brown Potter, under a Tuxedo Park address, endorsed Harriet Hubbard Ayers Cold Cream. Soon thereafter, in 1923, two agencies, William Estey and J. Walter Thompson, made heavy use of society names. Mrs. Oliver Harriman and the Duchess de Richelieu of Baltimore for Hardman Pianos. Mrs. Oliver Harriman, Mrs. August Belmont, and the formidable Mrs. Longworth of Washington for Pond's Cold Cream. Amory remarks that by 1960, whether because some persons of society, for example the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, had worn out their names by commercialism, or simply because fewer celebrities were real society, not a single Authentic Society name was on the most wanted list. A more attenuated form of endorsement does not even make any statement about a person's use or approval of the advertised product. This is the so-called implied endorsement. In this technique, the big name does not say in so many words that he uses the product. Instead, his name is associated with a product in such a way as to give it the aura of his name. A series of advertisements was run by the Sima Watch Company, announcing under a large portrait of J. Edgar Hoover that he had been given the Sima Honor Award watch. In the fabricating of endorsements, the planning and casting are all important. The least troublesome problem of all is how to make the statement true. In many cases, the implied endorsement, for example, the project is accomplished, the pseudo-event is created, merely by public association of the celebrity's name or photograph with the product. A sign of the celebrity is often that his name is worth more than his services. For an endorsement, the use of a name is frequently all that is wanted. A legend, true as fable, if not as fact, tells that at the end of the Civil War, an insurance company offered its presidency to General Robert E. Lee with a salary of $50,000 a year. General Lee was puzzled by the large salary, saying he did not think his services worth so much. "We don't want your services," he was told, "but only your name." "My name," Lee is reported to have said, "is not for sale." There are, of course, a few literal-minded celebrities who are hard to get. Some will actually refuse to say they use a product which they are not already in the habit of using. General Douglas MacArthur, for example, before 1957, had endorsed only the Sima watch. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt had endorsed only the Sima watch and the Zenith hearing aid. Sometimes the endorsement itself makes the endorser into a user. He is given a large supply of the product as payment for the endorsement. By the law of pseudo-events, the staging of the event inevitably becomes more interesting than the event itself. Everybody knows that big names are usually paid for their endorsements. A clever advertiser can actually increase interest by describing the process by which the endorsement was secured, even if it was paid for. The advertising agency working for Tom McCann's low-priced men's shoes published an ingenious series which attracted more than the usual attention, simply by having the endorsers purport to explain how their endorsements were paid for. In each case, a photograph of the endorser wearing Tom McCann's shoes appeared with a facsimile of his signature alongside the statement. Admiral J.J. Jocko Clark, U.S. Navy retired, for example, included the following in his endorsement. "My prejudice against Tom McCann's. In general, I have made it a personal rule to buy expensive shoes at $25 and $30 a pair. When asked to join the Tom McCann shoe jury, I was frankly skeptical. It's not always easy to teach an old sea dog new tricks. But Tom McCann's offer to send a check to my favorite charity, Navy Relief, was a strong inducement. Also, my Navy experience has shown me that it's never too late to learn, so I approached the test with an open mind. In America today, where popularity and well-knownness are themselves such valuable qualities of a product, the consumer himself is given an enticing opportunity to make advertising prophecies come true. The nationally advertised product is a celebrity of the consumption world. It is well known for its well-knownness, which is one of its most attractive ingredients. Just as each of us likes a movie star or a television celebrity more when we think we have had a hand in making him a celebrity, the same is true with commercial products. We know that by buying a product, we increase its popularity. We thus make it more valuable. Each of us has a power to help transform it into the leader in its field. This itself makes it more attractive to us and nearly everyone else. Each of us has the power to help make true the assertion that Chevrolet is the most popular car in the low-price field. One of the most effective efforts to increase beer consumption among women, and incidentally among men too, was the ingenious campaign by Liebman Breweries, aided by Foote, Cohn & Belding, Chicago Advertising Agency, and by Paul Hesse, the well-known photographer, to promote Rheingold beer. Their simple device was to let the consumers themselves vote for Miss Rheingold. This attractive model would then declare that Rheingold was her favorite beer and help entice those who had chosen her to entice them. The first national election for Miss Rheingold took place in 1941 when Ruth Ownby won. Jinx Falkenberg, who was the first Miss Rheingold, was undemocratically appointed, not elected. By 1957, the 20 million ballots cast in the election of Miss Rheingold made it the largest election in the United States outside of that for president. The fact that customers were allowed to vote more than once simply added to the tantalizing verisimilitude. Customers themselves seemed more effectively persuaded, more personally interested in being sold by a pseudo-event, which in this fashion they themselves had helped create. No one worried much over how to fabricate the essential fact, how to persuade the most popular model of the year to prefer Rheingold over all other beers. The contract, which candidates were required to sign, contained no mention of beer. A cynical advertising man observed that since beer was fattening, it was always unlikely that a model slim enough to win the election would actually be a heavy beer drinker. Reportedly, only one of the early winners drank much beer. But was it untrue for Miss Rheingold to say that, "My beer is Rheingold, the dry beer"? Any model who won the election, with its $50,000 in fees and prizes, would have been preternaturally callous not to like Rheingold best of all. What better way for securing truthful testimonials? In a world where brand names dominate, the consumer's power to bring the brand name into common use can make the brand name synonymous with the product itself. This, despite the legal perils of dissolving the right to the name, is much desired by the manufacturer. This is a verbal symbol of the consumer's power to make the product the success it claims to be. By daily use of the product and the word, the consumer actually makes Kodak his synonym for camera, Kleenex his synonym for paper tissue. In an expanding economy, where the very function of a commodity is often an aspect of the claimed qualities of a particular brand, for example, of a mouthwash like Listerine or of a deodorant like Dial soap or Ban, the consumer, by believing in the function and by developing his need, actually gives the product a new reality. 3. The appeal of the half-intelligible. In fast-moving, progress-conscious America, the consumer expects to be dizzied by progress. If he could completely understand advertising jargon, he would be badly disappointed. The half-intelligibility which we expect, or even hope to find in the latest product language, personally reassures each of us that progress is being made, that the pace exceeds our ability to follow. Who would want to live in an economy so stagnant, in a technology so backward, that the consumer could actually understand how products were made and what their real virtues were? The very obscurity of advertising language proves that manufacturers are really at work for our benefit, developing new processes, discovering, perfecting, and adding mysterious new ingredients, elaborating subtle and complicated new features. The consumer cannot be wholly satisfied, then, unless he is partly bewildered. Advertising is, of course, our most popular reading, listening, and watching matter, precisely because it transports us to where the rigidities of the real world have dissolved. As we stroll through the world of advertising, the half-intelligibility of what we see and read and hear encourages us to hope that our extravagant expectations may be coming true. To people who want the latest model but who do not understand automobiles, a V-type engine, hydromatic drive, wide track wheels, and uniweld body are especially appealing. These are scrupulously true statements of fact. Their appeal consists in our half-understanding. When the function of newly contrived objects becomes more attenuated, when an automobile is no longer merely a transportation machine, but something we wear and luxuriate in, or something that gives us that carefree feeling and that sense of indescribable luxury, when a ballpoint pen is no longer something to keep accounts with or to write checks with, but something vaguely useful for writing on butter or underwater, when a soap is not merely for washing, but to give us round-the-clock protection, then we can no longer be deceived about the function of anything. On a full-page, full-color portrait of an enticing woman who might be oneself, the lady reader is told, Ultima Gossamer Tints, the astonishing new color cosmetology. Dedicated by Revlon to the exciting woman who spends a lifetime living up to her potential. For the first time, you can be porcelain pale or spun gold, or any exquisite anything, without the vaguest feel of makeup on your skin. The key to this paradox? The limitless tints and almost bodiless textures of these gossamer powders, nutrient foundations, and lipsticks. Do let a Revlon consultant help you to a gossamer complexion at only the most distinguished stores. The Ultima Makeup Collection by Revlon, New York, London, Paris. In a world of functions so vague, so derivative, so attenuated, we read advertisements and listen to commercials to discover functions, ogres, needs, and perils of which we never dreamed and never would have known. Advertising attenuates, making everything more interesting, more fanciful, more problematic. 4. The Appeal of the Contrived. And we enjoy being courted. Like the little girl pleased to see her best beau stand on his head for her sake, we delight in the headstands and handsprings of advertisers. Not necessarily because we especially enjoy acrobatics, or even because the acrobatics are done so well, but because we are flattered that anyone would go to such trouble for us. When we see an elegant living room ensemble by Dunbar Furniture spread on a lawn, when we see the Pepperell family on Cotton Cay, imaginary island in the sun, poised improbably in an array of three hammocks, one above another. When we see a man hunting, fishing, or playing poker while chained to a large egg. For a better way to take care of your nest egg, talk to the people at Chase Manhattan. We are pleased. Not so much because we know what is happening or what it all means, or because the spectacle is anything but ludicrous. But because we cannot help being pleased that so elaborate a pseudo-event should be made especially for us. The shrewd planner of advertising pseudo-events plays on our puzzlement. Even our own suspicions and doubts themselves become themes for new pseudo-events. An advertising campaign in 1960 by Clairol Incorporated, makers of a hair dye for women, featured a photograph of an attractive model with beautiful hair. Over the photograph appeared the question, "Does she or doesn't she?" And underneath, "Hair color so natural, only her hairdresser knows for sure." The advertising copy which followed did not answer the tantalizing question. Someone wrote to the company for the facts. The enterprising publicity director then made news by releasing the story of the correspondence and the company's reply as follows. In response to your letter, the answer to your question, does she or doesn't she, is yes, always. I guess we at Clairol always knew that somewhere, someone would be bright enough to ask the very intelligent questions which you have put forth. Consequently, for as long as we have been doing national advertising, we have had an ironclad rule that all models used in our advertisements must use Miss Clairol on their hair. Girls who do not use our products on their hair just don't look good enough to reflect the true qualities of our hair coloring. The unanswered question, of course, was what relation, if any, there really was between using Clairol and having beautiful hair. The fact offered was that a girl with hair naturally beautiful enough to make her a cosmetic model had not spoiled her appearance by one application of Clairol. Here, obviously, the real interest centered not on the qualities of the product, but on the advertisement itself, the mechanics and mystery of the pseudo-event. When truth has been displaced by believability as the test of the statements which dominate our lives, advertisers' ingenuity is devoted less to discovering facts than to inventing statements which can be made to seem true. Making them seem true is relatively easy. With the apparatus of the graphic revolution, almost anything can be made to seem true, especially if we wish to believe it. The advertising man resembles the newspaper man, for whom he was in some ways the prototype. He artfully develops his pitch as the journalist cleverly develops his story. The happening, which the reporter sends over the wire, has often been incited into being in the same way in which the advertising man has produced the facts for his copy. Both aim at newsworthiness and believability. The advertising man, who, according to Endorsements Incorporated, may approach as many as 5 big names for a particular endorsement before he secures a single acceptance, is like the conscientious Washington reporter who approaches 7 senators before he finds the one to make the statement needed for his story. Both work hard to incite the pseudo-event into being. Both are inhabited by prudence and ethics. Believability is produced only if quasi-facts are invented within certain limits. But the problem is both complicated and simplified by the fact that in many fields of marketing, for example, drugs, cosmetics, automobiles, or home appliances, a statement cannot be most attractively believable unless it is only partly intelligible. The readers of advertisements are always playing a game with themselves. Momentarily, they enjoy the pleasurable illusion that an extravagant expectation has been satisfied. Then they enjoy the revelation that they have seen through the illusion. The fairy princess is not really a fairy princess at all, but only Jinx Falkenberg dressed up like one. Ample room is left for the advertiser's creativity. His imagination, like a poet's, enlarges our world for us. In the contest between the creative imagination of ad men and the disillusioning information and sophistication of ad readers, the successful advertiser stays one step ahead. He can keep us in that willing suspension of disbelief for the moment, which, according to Coleridge, constitutes poetic faith. He is always conceiving new legends for a world governed by its own legendary rules to take the place of those legends which have been disenchanted. The citizen consumer enjoys the satisfactions of being at the same time the bewitched, the bewitcher, and the detached student of witchcraft. The difficulty of curing us of our ever-exaggerating expectations comes from the very fact that not truth but credibility is the modern test. We share this standard with the advertising men themselves. For everybody, then, it is more important that a statement be believable than that it be true. This is illustrated by the spectacular success of a series of Rheingold beer testimonials. These were, of course, written by copywriters to suit the personalities of the celebrities who gave the endorsements. Although the agency helps out, Freeman explains in his Big Name, the endorsement is nonetheless sincere or believable. The foundation for the endorsement is the fact that these are well-known persons, believable as beer drinkers, who are well-liked and trusted by their publics. Some examples are Van Heflin, Victor Borge, Louis Armstrong, Ernest Borgnine, Nat King Cole, Sir Cedric Hardwick, Raymond Louis, Joanne Drew, Beatrice Lilly, Charles Coburn, Dorothy Kilgallen, and Groucho Marx. They would not put their names to a statement unless it were true, the readers believe, so that it is of little consequence that the actual choice of the words used to convey their approval of Rheingold is the work of another hand. The advertising world can never collapse so long as believability remains the test. Even as each old advertising formula becomes ritualized and its mechanics become widely known, the mechanics themselves become the pseudo-eventful center of interest. When a manufacturer of shaving cream was cited by the Federal Trade Commission for using toothpaste instead of shaving cream on a television commercial to show the supposedly remarkable underwater staying qualities of the shaving cream, the manufacturer inevitably benefited from the repetition of the brand name in this widely reported pseudo-event. We have already seen that in the news world, when the press conference became ritualized as a form of pseudo-event, it lost some of its charm and much of its function. When a looser, more ambiguous form of communication was required, the institutionalized leak was developed. Similarly, in the world of advertising, when the straight endorsement becomes ritualized and loses its appeal, new interest can be created by such devices as letting the public elect their own endorser, Miss Rheingold, or by showing them how the endorsements are bought and paid for, Tom McCann. There still remains enough of an always novel kind of believability. P.T. Barnum's flamboyant explanation of his success as a showman can serve now as prosaic description of our everyday experience. The world's way, Barnum observed, was to excite the community with flaming posters, promising almost everything for next to nothing. I confess that I took no pains to set my enterprising fellow citizens a better example. I fell in with the world's way. And if my puffing was more persistent, my advertising more audacious, my posters more glaring, my pictures more exaggerated, my flags more patriotic, and my transparencies more brilliant than they would have been under the management of my neighbors, it was not because I had less scruple than they, but more energy, far more ingenuity, and a better foundation for such promises. This might be the appropriately immodest motto for an expanding American economy, which thrives on our ever more extravagant expectations. 5. The central paradox, that the rise of images and of our power over the world blurs rather than sharpens the outlines of reality, permeates one after another area of our life. There is hardly a corner of our daily behavior where the multiplication of images, the products and byproducts of the graphic revolution, have not befogged the simplest old everyday distinctions. Life in medieval times, remarked the Dutch historian Johan Wizinga in his classic Waning of the Middle Ages, 1924, offered sharp edges and bright contrasts. Each season, each time of day, each station in society was clearly distinguished from others. Perhaps we can never recapture the poignancy which a medieval man felt in a warm fire on a winter day, in the sound of the leper's bell, in the dark of night, in the splendor of a nobleman's brocade. Equality and economic progress have leveled sensations. In rich, adept America, distinctions of social classes, of times and seasons, have been blurred as never before. With steam heat, we are too hot in winter, with air conditioning too cool in summer. Fluorescent lights make indoors brighter than out, night lighter than day. The distinctions between here and there dissolve. With movies and television, today can become yesterday, and we can be everywhere while we are still here. In fact, it is easier to be there, say on the floor of the National Political Convention, when we are here, at home or in our hotel room before our television screen, than when we are there. In 20th century America, we have gone one step beyond the homogenizing of experience. Not only do we begin to erase the distinctions of nature, our own distinctions become more impressive than nature's. Even as we try to sharpen our artificial distinctions, they become ever more blurry. A couple of examples will suffice. Take, for instance, our notion of time and the seasons. Measured by our economy, they become pseudo-events. As the machinery of production becomes more complex, as progress becomes ever more certain and more predictable, we must cautiously measure it out. Next year's model of an automobile, always out this year, is not the farthest step to which our technology can reach, but it is the farthest stage to which the pseudo-events of publicity and advertising can profitably be accommodated. It often represents not where progress has reached, but where it has been conveniently arrested. Advanced publicity becomes more important for everything produced. To change next year's model of automobile, we must have begun retooling 18 months before. Planning must have begun over 2 years in advance. The vast machinery of progress, then, makes every product express an obsolete imagination. Women's dresses for next summer must go on sale this winter, which means that they must have been designed and the new styles decided on at least last summer. Next year's designs are made before this year's have been sold. In publishing, for example, books for fall are announced before summer has come. In Publishers Weekly, Santa Claus arrives with his Christmas picture book gift items on the 4th of July. We anticipate ourselves so that manufacturers and merchandisers always live in several seasons at once. Not only news, but more and more other items of daily consumption are made for future release. The increasing importance of public relations in the world of politics and pressure groups has blurred the meaning of so simple a notion as membership. People cannot remember the names of the organizations they belong to. Money-raising counselors and professional managers of pressure groups must be adept not only at handling people, but especially at using names. Every year, more thousands of reams of stationery are printed with lists of advisory committees, sponsoring committees, and other fictitious bodies. Organizations are set up and dissolved to serve any purpose. The United States has historically been par excellence the country of voluntary organizations. Here, even churches have a voluntary character which they have had almost nowhere else in the world. But in the 20th century, ours has become the country of front organizations. In the United States, more and more organizations are pseudo-events, set up not because their members wish to collaborate for a common purpose, but because it serves someone's purpose that the founding and the activities of such organizations be widely reported. They are appendages of the media. They are front organizations, but not in the sense that they front for subversive causes. Rather, in the sense that their membership and sponsorship and leadership are carefully constructed not to do a job, but to produce an image. The fellow traveler, also a characteristic product of our age, is a person, of whatever political complexion, who allows himself to be associated with that image. Pressure to participate leads to more and more nominal membership in churches, service clubs, professional societies, pressure groups, charitable organizations, and political associations. Our joining is itself one of the most perfunctory of pseudo-events. We wish our membership to be reported. We do not care to participate. Multiplication of these personal pseudo-events confuses and dilutes our personal loyalties. The very idea of membership becomes hopelessly blurred. The Reader's Digest offered itself not as a magazine to be subscribed to, but as an association to be joined. We have book clubs and travel clubs and Christmas clubs and clubs and associations ad infinitum. Nowadays, it would be pedantic to say these are not clubs. But if they are properly clubs, it is simply because so few associations, except rural, obsolete, or snobbish groups, country clubs and downtown dining clubs and small sewing and reading circles, remain clubs at all in the traditional sociable sense. Are you a member or aren't you? I can't remember. The mark of an educated man, Irving Babbitt once shrewdly observed, is the clarity of the line in his mind between what he knows and what he does not know. Of course, this is only an ideal, but today it is more difficult than ever to reach for it. When in our schools the study of current events, that is, of what is reported in the newspapers, displaces the facts of history, it is inevitable that the standard of knowledge propagated by newspapers and magazines and television networks themselves, that is, whether one is up on what is reported in the newspapers, magazines, and television, overshadows all others. When to be informed is to be knowledgeable about pseudo-events, the line between knowledge and ignorance is blurred as never before. No wonder we use the quiz formula to test knowledge. No wonder our estimates of books and movies and television programs are shaped by whether they have won prizes, Pulitzers, Oscars, and Emmys, or have attained bestsellerdom. We should know them simply because they are well known. Having made celebrities, we have a duty to worship them. We worship them by keeping them alive, by keeping them well known. Distinction between knowledge and ignorance itself has become old-fashioned. It is displaced by the minute and barely discernible degrees of well-knownness. 6. Along with the blurring of knowledge, the multiplication and sharpening of images brings the blurring of our intentions and desires. Do not improved marketing techniques enable manufacturers to know what we want better than we do ourselves? New ambiguities enter into desire and function. Does the public really want fins on its new model automobiles? If the fins do satisfy a public want, are they not then somehow functional? We become more and more confused about our desires in an ever-expanding economy where products are always remoter from primitive needs. We read advertisements then to discover and enlarge our desires. We are always ready, even eager, to discover from the announcement of a new product what we have all along wanted without really knowing it. The ambiguity of desire and of function come along together. Function was once a word for describing a simple standard of utility. By contrast, an ornament was supposed to be only subsidiary to the object's function. But we become more uncertain what is the precise usefulness of any particular product. That usefulness itself becomes a kind of pseudo-event, a utility made up for the purpose of being reported. We then find ourselves occupied less with finding products to perform certain obvious functions than with discovering what is the real function of the objects that we think we want. The search for function, as anyone who has lived in a modern functional house knows, is just as uncertain as the search for beauty. A symptom of the blurring of our intentions and desires by the increases of images is the rising interest in public opinion, and especially in public opinion polls. Although the expression public opinion dates from at least as early as the end of the 18th century, Jefferson used it, it came into common use only in the era of the graphic revolution. The multiplication of news reports multiplied the supposed evidence of the opinion of the people generally. Of course, what was printed as opinion, and what was therefore most widely available, was not everybody's opinion, but only a few symptoms. Still, with rising literacy and extending circulation, there came an increasing tendency to take the symptom for the fact. The digests, the Literary Digest and the Reader's Digest, for example, and the many new forms of opinion reporting in other magazines and newspapers, gave public opinion a specious new reality. In his brilliant, pioneering book, Public Opinion, 1922, Walter Lippmann made a valuable distinction. The pictures inside the heads of these human beings, the pictures of themselves, of others, of their needs, purposes, and relationship, are their public opinions. Those pictures which are acted upon by groups of people, or by individuals acting in the name of groups, are public opinion with capital letters. After the graphic revolution, it was possible to make images of public opinion, with many of the general characteristics I have observed for all images. Public opinion now became synthetic, believable, passive, vivid, concrete, simplified, and ambiguous as never before. If you wanted to know what the public thought, you could simply pick up a newspaper. Changes were recorded daily or twice daily. Opinions were vivified by journalese and by photographs. They were forced into being by earnest newspapermen trying to make news. They were played against one another. Inevitably, then, public opinion became itself a kind of pseudo-event, forced into existence for the primary purpose of being reported. Expressions of public opinion became among the most powerful, the most interesting, and the most mysterious of pseudo-events. The more fabricated and factitious public opinion became, true to the law of pseudo-events, the more interesting and titillating the news about it became. Democracies, Lippmann shrewdly observed, have made a mystery out of public opinion. There have been skilled organizers of opinion who understood the mystery well enough to create majorities on election day. But these organizers have been regarded by political science as low fellows or as problems, not as possessors of the most effective knowledge there was on how to create and operate public opinion. The tendency of the people who have voiced the ideas of democracy, even when they have not managed its action, the tendency of students, orators, editors, has been to look upon public opinion as men in other societies looked upon the uncanny forces to which they ascribed the last word in the direction of events. Lippmann made a plea for better, more effective, more widely understood news apparatus. He observed that the quality of the news about modern society was an index of its social organization. The better the institutions, then the more objective the news, the more effectively issues could be disentangled, and the more perfectly an affair can be presented as news. Lippmann's interpretation did not take sufficient account of how the mere existence and proliferation of media would produce pressures to fabricate, complicate, and dramatize, and hence to misrepresent, and how the interestingly contrived account would tend to overshadow the naively accurate facts. Again, true to the laws of pseudo-events, public opinion bred its own interest-awakening novelties. Even if there was no opinion spontaneously expressed, elaborate new devices would incubate opinions into expression so they could be reported, discussed, and set against one another. These devices, one critic warned, seek to turn the people into a great beast, which is asked to roar when it is not ready to do so. Public opinion polls are an example. There had been straw polls in the United States as early as July 24, 1824, when the Harrisburg Pennsylvanian sent to Wilmington, Delaware, to gather samples of opinion on the presidential campaign and reported Andrew Jackson, 335 votes, John Quincy Adams, 169, Henry Clay, 19, William H. Crawford, 9. Since then, there have been many straw polls. They have often helped increase the circulation of magazines and newspapers. The best known in this century were the Literary Digest polls between 1916 and 1936. The modern scientific sampling technique for surveying public opinion did not, however, develop out of these crude earlier polls. Instead, it grew, appropriately enough, out of research in marketing and advertising. Market surveys were devised about 1912 by Roy O. Eastman to find out who was reading the magazines in which his breakfast food ads were appearing. By 1919, a survey department appeared within an advertising agency. Then, independent surveying organizations were established. More recently, opinion surveying has become a sizable industry, training and employing thousands of interviewers, mailing out hundreds of thousands of questionnaires, sparing neither time nor expense in lengthy depth interviews. A host of novel techniques have been elaborated for securing expressions of opinion and for finding the motives behind the opinions. These have been directed mostly to consumers. In 1935, market research techniques were applied to politics and public issues. Fortune was the first to publish widely the results of such surveys, conducted under the direction of Elmo Roper and others. And then George Gallup offered his features on a regular syndicated basis to numerous newspapers. Beginning in 1936, What the Polls Say during national campaigns became one of the most interesting and widely featured pieces of news. The spectacular failure in 1936 of the Literary Digest poll, which until then had been remarkably accurate, but which forecast a sweeping victory for Landon over Roosevelt and mispredicted the popular vote by a full 20%, actually stimulated a wider interest in opinion polls. The Digest fiasco was itself one of the biggest pieces of news about the election. When the Digest collapsed, other polls, for example those by Fortune, by Archibald M. Crossley, by George Gallup, by the National Opinion Research Center, took over. In 1944, a poll by a national polling agency showed that over half of its informants had heard of public opinion polls. In 1948, once again, the best-known national opinion polls predicted the wrong result, choosing Dewey over Truman. Elmo Roper's Fortune poll missed the actual popular vote by 12%. Both Crossley and Gallup had given Dewey a 5% popular lead. Yet again, within 6 months of this fiasco, market research agencies and public opinion polls were functioning at their 1948 levels. In the succeeding presidential elections, as more elaborate polling techniques were perfected and as voters became accustomed to following the polls became the political equivalent of the racing form. They became more and more interesting for their own sakes. Now, politicians and pundits were constantly being asked not merely about the issues and the candidates and the state of public sentiment, but about the meaning of specific polls. People speculated about the effect on voters of revealing this or that set of figures. After each election, one of the most widely interesting news items was the degree of accuracy of each of the different polls. Prominent pollsters were interviewed, encouraged to speculate, explore, defend, and wonder over their results. The experts have, of course, been preoccupied with explaining and defending the basis of their mispredictions. In their postmortems, they have focused their interest not on the actual opinions gathered, never, of course, gathered at the moment and in the places where legally valid votes are actually cast, but rather on comparison of the artificial election, by opinion pollers, with the real election, at the ballot box. Some scientific polling experts, like George Gallup, have been anxious to prove that opinion polling is an aid rather than a menace to representative democracy. In his Pulse of Democracy, 1940, Gallup concludes with an unintended ominousness that the limitations and shortcomings of the polls are the limitations and shortcomings of public opinion itself. The deepest peril of polls comes, however, not from their inaccuracy, but from their accuracy. If and when polls become so scientific that they can precisely predict our opinions at the ballot box, at that moment they may cease to be very interesting. At the same time, of course, the process of voting will have become superfluous. The defenders of the polls, like Gallup, declare that polls are valuable, even essential, for what they now define as our representative government. Government responsive to the average opinion of mankind. The larger problem, which the rising interest in public opinion and public opinion polls illustrates, is the rise of images and their domination over our thinking about ourselves. We hopefully exaggerate our expectations of the power of these polls to predict how we will decide. The more confidence pollsters can inspire in their power to offer us an image of what we will really believe or will choose at some future time, the more blurred becomes our notion of what is our own real preference as voters. Here again arise some of our most bewildering blurs, produced by some of the most sharply contrived images. Just as in the world of news, the roles of the actor and the reporter have been more or less intermixed. Through press conferences, news releases, institutionalized leaks, and other devices. So the same is true of manufacturer and consumer, political leader and political follower, statesman and citizen. Now the consumer can look at advertisements to see what he really wants. The best manufacturers make only products which they are convinced the consumer really wants. Now the citizen can see himself in the mirror of the opinion polls. Having been polled as a representative of the public, he can then read reports and see how he looks. As polls become more scientific and detailed, broken down into occupations, counties, income groups, religious dominations, etc., the citizen can discover himself. And the opinions which he ought to have or is likely to have, in the views reported as predominant among people like him. Public opinion, once the public's expression, becomes more and more an image into which the public fits its expression. Public opinion becomes filled with what is already there. It is the people looking in the mirror.